Hi, I'm the Dark Tangent, and you're about to listen to some speeches from DEF CON 2, held at the Sahara Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada, 1994, July 22nd to the 24th. This speech and all speeches are copywritten, the Dark Tangent and DEF CON Communications, all rights reserved, except permission is granted for educational nonprofit use. Now, the Sahara, like most other hotels DEF CON's been at, has since been blown up to make way for a bigger and better hotel. So with that in mind, sit back, relax, get ready for some good speeches.
Hi, is this on? Yes, good. Okay. Wow, hi, Jeff. Okay, we have some people here who are going to talk to you. And one of them is the mystery hacker on the end, who you probably know at present, who came 16 hours to be here. And he's going to, he's no longer a mystery. I just wasn't sure if he would be here or not. He drove 16 hours to be here, or flew or something, anyways, here. And then we have Mark, who's from General Research Corporation, who's going to talk about his feelings about government interest and privacy. We have Phil Zimmerman. He wrote a program about with encryption. You probably know him. And we have Strata over here, who works with design of anonymous networks, which I personally think don't exist. And I need the next slide so I can tell you why. Click. One of the things that they'll talk about is the anonymous remailer. And for an example, we'll use this one here. And on TNetSpy. That's my personal favorite. I think it was the first one compromised, the only one compromised that I know for sure about. So we'll talk a little bit about that one. I think Presence will talk about that one. And the problems involved in creating anonymous mailers over here. PGP easily compromised. And before everybody goes, oh, God, it's been cracked, it's not quite like that. It's more like it's really easy to compromise if the person using it is not very knowledgeable, or if they're very lazy, or maybe a little bit stupid. So Phil's going to talk to us about how to use it correctly and make sure that we do that. Because you'd be really surprised. I meet a lot of people who tell me they use PGP. So I send them a message with my little signature attached at the bottom, which I do with plain text ASCII. You know how you get the little signature at the bottom? And it says, only I send forged messages to people from other people with their signatures at the bottom, and they never verify to see if it's really that person. And then they think they really got a message from that person, and they're sure they really did because it was signed at the bottom with that little block of text. So in addition to not doing something... Yeah, it's just stupidity. But Phil's here to remind us not to be stupid, and so that we make really good use of his product, and maybe he'll talk a little bit about policy, which is his favorite subject. Anonymous networks, again, they don't exist, but we'll talk about them anyway. Click. Sniffers. We would be very remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about sniffers. So that sniffers right there, device NIP, promiscuous mode, everybody knows about it. If you want a better patch, probably you should get Beavis and Butthead patch. It's a lot better. And if you don't have it and you need it, ask me. It's everywhere. If you don't believe me, you can ask CERT. And if you don't believe them, you can look up some of their machines, because some of the CERT machines have the sniffers on them, but they won't admit it, but that's just how it goes. Click. Yeah, click. Oh, back to these anonymous remailers. Well, I don't know why people think they're really so safe and that nobody knows who you are when you use them, because it's not quite that simple. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Some of the reasons that they're not safe, including faulty design, faulty implementation, and inadequate safeguard, but the primary reason being those people at the bottom in green, which are supposed to look like us, all those people on terminals, users, users, users. Click. So you're almost finished listening to me, and you'll get to listen to people who really know what they're talking about. My last words would be to tighten up your security. If you don't have it tightened up, use PGP correctly, because if you don't, it's not worth using, and it's really a good thing, so you should use it right, tell other people how to use it. Don't just trust the people you're working with are using it correctly. You may have to ask them, because in the end, you're the only person who's responsible for your security. Nobody will do it for you. And don't take privacy for granted, because it's not your right. And even if it is your right, there are a lot of people around there who think it's their right to make sure you don't have it. So with that, we'll start with Presence on the end, who can start talking, and he has from 5 to 7 minutes and go. Click.
Would you guys rather have me stand, or do you want me to sit here?
Sit. Hackerific, I tell you.
Okay. I'm not an orator. This is the first time I've spoken to more than, like, three people. So, you'll be kind, or just be me. What I'm here to talk about, first we'll talk about anonymous remailers, in specific, the anonymous Pennant remailer. The way these things work is you mail your responses or mail to be mailed out to a server that basically handles your mail, kind of mutates it into its own form, adds its own address to the end with your supposed, you know, mail account, and mails it to your delivery parcels. Now, you know, this is fine and dandy. When you have people that don't know about networks, you have people about, 15, 16 years old, and I'm not saying that they are ignorant, because they're not, but that see these things as being secure. Things are only as secure as the people you're dealing with. I'm not saying the people in non-Pennet are unreliable or immoral, but what you're doing here is you're trying to work things through so you don't pass on your information to somebody else. It might be a malicious person, somebody that you might consider hazardous. What happens here, and this is where I was tying the snippers, there are security issues within these remailers, okay? Anonymity is a hard thing. It's not a simple thing. It's not for people who are ignorant or people who are not willing to take time out to get the thing working correctly. What happens on the internet, when you mail things or you send a packet or you make a connection, your IPs are sent along with the packet to tell where to go. Now, this probably is a real simple fact, and most people understand this. So what happens is somebody comes to your home, they know where you come from maybe they don't know where you come from, they do know where non-Pennet is, they stick a sniffer on Pennet, find out where packets are coming from, and read your mail. Or, necessarily, they can read your packets coming out of your machine, they might have a sniffer before Pennet, they might have a sniffer after Pennet. If you stack these remailers, they can have a sniffer between every remail. This is not a difficult process. A lot of this is automated, really simple things to provide for yourself. I'll explain what a sniffer is. I don't know if everybody here knows what a sniffer is. A sniffer, what it is it monitors an Ethernet device for raw information coming over the network. It may not be just Ethernet devices, but for the most part, Ethernet devices are what you utilize. The raw information that comes in on the Ethernet device is stored to a file in raw format or through a filter, and they can read these files to determine who is sending the information and where the information is supposed to go if it follows to another place. So you see where I'm saying that if you do, say you use Telnet and go from your home site to another site, say GNU in this case, if they have a sniffer at GNU, they can see that you're coming from the home where you're coming from, because the IP packets are, you connect from your site to GNU, the IP packets are there to tell you where you're coming from. This is a security measure, basically. They could have stripped this, you know, stripped the packets as they come in, but something has to handle the packets, or you don't get where you're supposed to go. It's an inherent flaw in the system. I don't think it was a design flaw. I think it's a flaw that's necessary. There are certain ways to try to conceal yourself on the network. Although I must say there is no real true way to hide your identity. They can trace back to at least the node that you are connected to, maybe not your node. Through source routing, you may be able to divert some of the information that you want to send out to another node. Is there any confusion here? A node is a machine that's set on the network, not necessarily individual. But the intention here for anonymity is you really don't want anybody to know. Maybe you don't want somebody to know your email address and send you all kinds of messages. Maybe you don't want anybody to know what your name is. They can call the university and social engineer the rest of your information. You don't want your telephone number out there. I understand. These are things you need to know because there are malicious people out there that are out to get you just because you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, or because they don't like you for your beliefs, or because you just happen to be with somebody that they didn't like. There's a lot of implications that they put upon you because of your associations. Maybe they don't like the people that you're, you know, coming, the sites you're coming from, they don't like the people who are running that. That's the case a lot of times at GNU. I'm not going to go on with that, but, you know, people that come from GNU are persecuted about specific things. What you, with the information that you want to pass on, the only way you really can secure yourself in anonymity is make sure that people understand around you, the people that you hold dear to you, are trusted people. You have to make sure these people are people you trust. You don't give information to somebody that you don't know. You do not want to be, you know, you can tell everybody in the world anything about yourself. You have that option. If you trust the person, then it's very possible that that information is safe. Anonymity with sniffers, you have more than just sniffers. Anonymity with sniffers and people have access that normally wouldn't have access to your information. It basically, it's a non-existent really option. I call it an option because you don't have to do it, but it's a non-existent option. I see a lot of faces.
We have to change to the next person now. If people have questions for Brendan, they would ask them after we're finished up here. I think our second person is Strata with Virtual City Network. She's going to talk about anonymous network design. I'm going to be her slide person. So if you want to come up here, and I'll go down there.
I know that people said earlier they preferred people to sit, but if I can't see my own slides, I won't be able to talk. I'm one of those people. So my name's Strata Rose. I've been doing a thing called the Virtual City Network Project. We're doing, in this case, means mostly design for the last year because real-world considerations like rent and salary have cut in. Okay, we may not be able to fit all of that on the screen. Basically, this is a quick list of what are things that you can currently find out about someone or something using a network. Specifically email related if you're trying to find out who someone really is. Some remailers, and they shall remain nameless, have internal tables of real IDs or email addresses mapped to anonymous names. This is very bad. This is a no-no. You can do standard system logging on mail messages that tracks date, time, size, sender, recipient. This is the syslog on my Unix machine. You can do connection monitoring on a host or on a network, and you can find out host A opened a connection to host B and received this many packets. You can do phone tree monitoring. There, I believe at CFP, the statistic was there are about 10,000 phone bills that are being received by the government without any sort of warrant process that are gone through, and they make phone trees of all the people that those people call and get their phone bills and so on and so forth. So if you're depending on FidoNet or some other phone-based service to pass anonymous mail, you might get a rude surprise. Random stupidity, people putting their real name in the messages, putting their real email addresses, that's life. And depending on where you're logging in from, if it's not your own machine or if it's a university machine, log in and possibly process time. So they can say you were sending mail at 8 o'clock and correlate it back with all the other information. The model I'm about to present depends on certain infrastructure, which is pretty much already in place. We have key servers. We can make new and better key servers if necessary. We have an infrastructure which has interest in anonymous remailers enough so that if we put out the bigger and better mousetrap anonymous remailer, people will pick it up and take it. We have transport agents. We have PGP. And we have a rich set, source of text on the net to pad messages from. So basically, let's see, what we need to use this concept, which I'm calling Anubis, which is anonymity via Unix-based information services. We can write on Unix later. Also, there's Kerberos, and if you want to run with the big dogs, you have to be a jackal. So you need a registered public key, an Anubis mailer compatible user agent, a local copy of PGP, which obviously you have if you've registered public key, an SMTP compliant mail gateway, and a rich source of text from which to pad messages and generate ringer messages. And actually, those, is that slightly out of order? Draft. That's the order I put them in. Well, I'm stupid. Okay, so when you start a mailer session, this is basically an outline of what you want to do. No code has been written yet. I've just been doing the design. You contact the mailer, a mailer, with your user agent. We assume that there are a bunch of mailers. The mailers talk to each other in the fashion that, say, Usenet exchanges NMTP messages. They exchange at fixed times, fixed blocks of encrypted text, and it is not known what the contents of this text is, and it reliably changes hands. So it is not clear from any sort of network monitoring whether or not significant information is being exchanged. They can monitor until they turn blue in the face. They don't know what's salt, and they don't know what's text. So the Anubis mailer looks up, uses key servers, looks up the public key of Foo, who I say I am, from N key servers, where N is a small random number. If it can't get an answer from the different key servers, it'll inform you of this and only transmit ringer text for the rest of the session. If the majority of key servers disagree about your key, it will inform you about this and close the connection. And it will grab a random piece of text from a text store, do a challenge, you'll answer the challenge back. Periodically, the mailer will query key servers about its own key pair. And if it finds significant disagreement in the key servers, the mailer will assume that someone is trying to screw with the mailer and will inform everybody that tries to connect to it, hey, somebody's trying to fuck with me. Don't trust anything I say. So anyway, next slide, or further up on the slide. Yeah, next slide. Basically, once you've authenticated yourself, your identity is confirmed. You can send outbound messages, which your mailer agent will work into the padded text. You can collect messages that are bound for you if they're only held at the mailer. You can transmit control strings asking it to update its tables about you. All that would be known in the table of a mailer like this would be that there existed a certain anonymous identity and there were preferences about delivery for messages going to that identity. You can set your pickup info. This mailer, this zone, because there are zones, there would be a news group where you could just send a block of encrypted text to the news group with a certain subject, and you could set the mailer so that if someone wants to reply to you, then what happens is that reply is picked up by the mailer, posted to the news group, and then you get to read it from wherever you read the news group from, because the idea is to erase the trail of you receiving the message. If the news group is going out to hundreds of people, then how do they know who you are? We're trying to make it so that no one can put the link between the anonymous name and you. Next slide. And let me know if I'm running out of time here. Close. Okay. So what I can find out by monitoring your network and watching the mailers is I can see you contact the mailer every time period, you pass this amount of traffic, it contacts you, this, you know, pass this amount of traffic. What I don't see further on down in the slide there, I can't see the boundaries between what the salt of the encrypted chain is and your private message. I can't see your header info because it's wrapped into the message. I can't see the challenge. And I can't really see a direction because they're just sort of handing off, bam, 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 bam. In fact, we could even open, you know, a dual session and have it simultaneously be handing information back and forth. And I also can't see a record of what NIMS keys you queried the servers for because you're querying your key servers on your own time. That's basically it. In order to do sort of devil's advocacy, I thought to myself, what can I find out by running a compromised mailer? If I'm like spook.gov and I want to run one of these mailers to try to find out as much as I can from people using them, these are basically the things that I can find out. You'll note that none of these things is the actual text of the message. Because it's presumed that people are intelligent enough to encrypt the messages that they're sending outbound, and they will be further wrapped by the mailer. So even if someone's running a compromised mailer, if they unwrap it, all they get is, surprise, your encrypted text. Now, a large part of this rests on having reliable public key servers. I deliberately set out from a position of total ignorance about the current state of key servers and anonymous remailers. I said to myself, I need to find out what's going on in this area, but I'll pretend I don't know anything, which I don't, and design for an ideal world. So I don't know if current key servers are reliable enough to to support this sort of transport yet. I know I've heard of problems where people are registering keys, quote-unquote, with the servers in other people's names. And this is obviously not a good thing, and I'm not going to even address how we do that sort of authentication. But I think it is possible to get to a point where we have key servers that are secure enough so that you can pull a random anonymous identity out of the air and establish a key for it. Because if you're picking a random identity as opposed to trying to establish your own identity, you can secure the random identity just by naming it and putting it out there, blasting it out to the existing key servers. And that's about all I have to say.
Thank you. The next person we have is Phil Zimmerman, who is going to tell us how to hack TGP, sort of.
Yeah.
That's what he says.
In 7 minutes. Okay. Well, you know, the PGP user's guide tells you how to protect yourself against these hacks, so in some ways I prefer to let natural selection take its course. And RTFM, you know. Well, there's a few ways of doing it. One is accepting public keys without signatures, as we just heard. If you get public keys from the network, they ought to be signed by people that you trust. I see that people often put their public keys out there without any signatures on it, and I don't understand. You know, didn't they read the manual? I guess not. People accept keys without signatures on it. You know, two-thirds of the code in PGP is written to solve that particular problem, and it's not being used by people who don't understand that. So, the Achilles heel of any public key crypto system is to put your own name on somebody, put your own key with somebody else's name on it, and put it out there and hope that people use it to send messages to that person, and instead of sending it to their true key, then you can read all of their mail. Any good, well-implemented public key crypto system implementation spends a lot of effort in solving that one problem, and so does PGP, and solves it pretty well, I think. So that's one way you can do it. Another is if you use PGP on a multi-user system, if you leave your secret key on there, then maybe somebody could get it. Perhaps the root could get it, if it's a Unix system. you ought not to do that. I sure don't do that. I understand that Sarah was just telling me this morning that there are sniffers that have been developed to sniff passphrases for PGP. Well, you shouldn't be executing PGP on a remote host system where you type your passphrase over a network or over a modem connection. I never do that, but if you do that, you're taking a risk of exposing your passphrase to a sniffer. If they can get your passphrase and they can also get your secret key from the disk, then they've got you. They know your true name. They can cast spells on you. Leaving your secret key on not just a multi-user system, but any untrusted system on an office computer at night, perhaps somebody could get in and get a copy of your secret key. Then they would have to know your passphrase, which they might be able to, if you're dumb enough to do that, they might be able to just take that little yellow stick-on note that you've got right over your screen that has your passphrase on it and use that too. A lot of PCs are networked together. Even though each PC is not itself a multi-user system, if they're networked together, it is possible for hostile software to come over the network and execute on your PC without your knowledge and examine your keystrokes, all of your keystrokes, including your passphrase, and possibly get your secret key as well. one way to prevent this from happening, I guess, in the long run, if we ever get to the into the hardware technology infrastructure, is to have smart cards. The smart cards would have a processor on them that would be able to perform public key calculations, your secret key calculations, and it would have your secret key in it. So the secret key would be locked up within the same hardware perimeter as the processor that performs the calculations with your secret key. Then your secret key never leaves that card but it doesn't have to. I mean, I'm not talking about like a magnetic stripe card or a memory card, smart card, where you stick it in the computer reads your secret key and performs the calculations in the desktop computer. I'm talking about a processor on your smart card that performs the calculations with the secret key, so there's no reason to let the secret key, or sometimes called the private key, leave the smart card. Then we could carry that around in our wallet. We could type in a PIN or a passphrase or something that would enable it. That would be a nice thing to have. We aren't there yet, so what we've got is a pure software solution instead that's vulnerable to hostile software that runs on your computer. What you have to do is to make sure that you run on a trusted system that contains no hostile software. The PGP User's Guide has a chapter on vulnerabilities. There's some more outlandish possibilities. Tempest attacks where radiation radio frequency emissions from your computer could be detected from afar. I doubt very much that that's a realistic attack in any of our things that we're likely to run into, although everybody seems to be concerned about it. Half the people I know believe their phone is tapped too, so I don't know if mine is even, you know. Probably is, but so I guess that's all I can think of off the top of my head. You know, I think there's infrastructure attacks like the fact that we can put keys out there without signatures on them. You know, maybe we could try to shore it up or beef it up a little more by having a better, more filled-in web of trust for people to sign keys, well-known people to sign a lot of keys. People are always sending me their keys, asking me to sign them. I almost never sign them, so please don't do that. So that's about it. Yeah, I'd actually rather talk about policy issues because it's more fun. This is kind of boring, and besides, rather let natural selection weed out the people that don't read the manual. So anyway, I guess I'll turn it over to Mark or Sarah or somebody.
Thanks, Bill. The next person is Mark Aldrich, who's with General Research Corporation. I'm not sure if he's representing them here today or not.
No.
He's not representing
no.
them here today, definitely. So he's going to talk about his ideas about governmental nightmares or something. And I don't know how to turn that mic on.
There's obviously the man.
There we go. Thank you.
No, I need to issue the standard disclaimer. All the opinions presented here are mine. They don't have a damn thing to do with anybody I work with. The actual title of my presentation today was supposed to be Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Part 3, or Honey, Have You Seen My Yoke of Oppression? And what happened is this whole thing started because of a bumper sticker that I saw, and I began doing research for what eventually made me an article. And that bumper sticker said, Fear the government that fears your guns. And after a while, I started thinking, what happens if I take the word gun and put in cryptography instead? Fear the government that fears your cryptography. And so what I did is began researching some of the aspects of the Constitution, because particularly when we were at CFP, in between FBI raids, we had a lot of people up there discussing, you know, problems with privacy and people reading stuff and all that. And I was much more concerned with some other fundamental problems that I thought had gotten severely hosed up besides just the privacy issue. So what I began doing was researching some material on the Second and Third Amendment. And these amendments, of course, were based on the right to keep and bear arms and the fact that you could not quarter soldiers in people's homes. I began looking at the concept that perhaps rather than cryptography being a method by which we could protect our Fourth Amendment rights, that in fact what we could do is use cryptography as a weapon. And when I began looking at this, come to find out, the government is already doing that. Now, after we ratified our Constitution, The Constitution split the government into three parts, and excuse me a moment. I think it was a bunch of printed material, and I had to tear it apart at the last minute because I was going to go over. So that's why I'm fumbling a bit here. After we developed the Constitution with the various amendments and so forth, we had a group of people who felt that hopefully the government would never be able to turn itself into a corrupt body. However, if we move through history, we see any number of instances where, in fact, it did. We were a nation with institutionalized slavery, a nation that fed radioactive waste to its own citizens just to see what would happen. We took 110,000 Japanese Americans and incarcerated them. In 1942, each of them was held an average of 900 days each. They were held without charge, without counsel, and without trial. And yet, even with the Second Amendment in place, the right to keep and bear arms, nobody did anything to stop this. Now, what has happened is the federal government, the so-called limited government that is defined in our Constitution, is not being able to branch out of the three sections of which it is formed, is in fact arming itself with a very powerful weapon, escrow key cryptography. However, the really ludicrous thing to this, to me at least, is not the threat that it's got to citizens' privacy, but if we look at our Second Amendment, where it indicates that we have to at all times be able to raise a state militia such that we can go up against the federal government, for some reason the government is proposing to escrow the keys itself. Now, what I want to know is, why is it the states and citizens aren't going to have the keys if this, in fact, is a problem? Now, I don't mean to dismiss the need for privacy. And there is an actual amendment in the Constitution, the Third Amendment, that has never been interpreted by the Supreme Court. And that is the amendment that says you cannot house troops in people's homes. And what I would ask is, if we can get a little bit science fiction-like here, let's say one day you were driving home from work, and when you arrived at your home, there in your driveway was RoboCop. Okay? And upon asking this android what it's doing there, it says that by order of the federal government, you will house it in your home and, of course, provide access to 120-volt electrical outlet upon demand. Now, just about anybody's going to say that an android like that is going to be a violation of the Third Amendment that stops people from ordering troops in people's homes. It's very easy to anthropomorphize an android and do the same thing as what we would call a soldier in the Constitution, even though it's a cybernetic soldier. But I would ask you, instead of something that looked like RoboCop, what happened if the soldier they wanted to quarter in your home looked like this? A single integrated circuit. And if you say that's bullshit, all it is a chip, I need to ask you this. How many degrees of separation are there between one single IC and an android composed of many that is in fact a soldier of the government? At what point are you going to get worried? When it's two chips, five chips, when it's got the ability to talk, the ability to walk, or does it have to be able to pull a gun out and point it up against your head before you're going to get worried? And in fact, what can we do under the amendment that provides us with the right to keep and bear arms such that we can form a militia to counteract these things? And I've been working on some research to discuss several ideas. Unfortunately, I think I don't have enough time to do it here. But I would suggest that rather than just looking at the right to privacy, that we also look at some of the other threats that are being presented to us, such as the fact that we are currently incapable of stopping the federal government, even the military, who's already equipped with cryptography. And I would also question those people who are looking for various activities that may or may not be that productive. And I have a couple suggestions for you. Rather than building something like a politically incorrect virus, why don't you try and come up with some way to take down the military's command and control systems? Because there's currently no way that the National Guard in each state is ever going to be able to do that. And instead of necessarily trying to figure out some way to hack PGP or something like that, I think a lot of folks might be interested in a project called the Mobile Subscriber Equipment. And I know a lot of people around are into cellular hacking and so forth, but previous to the cellular technology being introduced widely in the public, the military already built a cellular telephone system. Except the damn thing is an FM frequency hopping capability. that basically enables them to put a touch-tone phone in every foxhole, and it relies upon none of the cellular infrastructure in this country. I would suggest that if somebody's looking for a really good research project, they might want to tinker with that one. So, when Schwartz mentioned on several occasions the need for a constitution for cyberspace, and quite honestly, trying to look at the current constitution that we have, I don't think that we're going to be able to extrapolate it correctly in cyberspace. And I would like to second my vote to Wayne's position that we do need to construct a constitution and a national information policy in order to deal with these problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Does anybody have any questions?
Does anybody have any questions?
Questions. Okay, you.
Right, and that's the thing that worries me. I agree with you. I think that, in fact, that cryptography can be viewed as a weapon. There was a really good point made, I guess it was Mr. Sterling, who said, cryptography is not your friend. It's mathematics. It's a tool. And like anything else, whether it be guns, cryptography, or radio equipment, it's not the technology that's inherently good or bad. It's how much responsibility you have when you exercise it. And therefore, there's any number of these technologies that, in fact, could be interpreted as weapons. The difficulty is that the current precedent in the court, I believe, will preclude any of you from being able to get it up even to the Supreme Court level if, in effect, they came to your door, took the stuff away from you, and you said, no, the right to keep and bear arms, you know, you can't do this to me, so.
Okay.
This is back to our moderator from our, and those of our first speaker. Were you meaning to be provocative only in the slide that says the PNS remailer is insecure, PGP is compromised? Were those really meant to be provocative headlines, or do you actually think that? Is there any evidence to believe that? When you say PGP compromised, I mean, it's somewhat catastrophic. I mean, I can imagine if there's press here, press on the media.
Of course. I think Philip explained the ways that PGP can be compromised and that it can be used unsuccessfully. And there are ways. Right. Well, to the person who wrecks their car, it's important that they know that they should have worn seatbelts. And the whole point of the slide was to tell people it's not as simple as, oh boy, I have PGP, I can use it without any effort. As far as the,
use this non-compromised, very good encryption system the way it was intended to be done, and the issues about unsigned keys, the entire basis of PGP and similar systems are either a web of trust or a certificated authority, and not doing that is like saying, I'm trying to avoid the highway metaphors or something. It's like, yes, they need to go on and out.
Well, that's a good point. I probably really can't answer that this short of time. But you ask about the anonymous remailer. Is it yes, it's compromised. Yes. What? Yes. Yes.
I talked to him for hours about the design of that system, and saying theoretically, yes, you could put a sniffer beat, you know, that
I'm not speaking theoretically.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
No, but some evidence that it is other than theoretical would be nice. Otherwise, you're both.
If you would like to meet with me afterwards, I can give you that quite possibly. I have seen a portion of the database. I have asked for a name from the database, giving only a number. The names were given to me. So I'm reasonably sure, having asked for a name with no identifying number, given a number, gotten a name of an individual that was not known to the person I asked. Now, the person compromised it is not here. He's not on this panel, so he can't really answer. I can answer as far as what I've seen. I've seen a portion of the database that would be proof to me that it's compromised. Sorry.
In just a slide note for a moment, if you've got a problem with that bullet, How do you think I felt when she put on the slide government interest? I've already had like five people go, oh, he's got to get that.
The
government interest.
The slides were made the slides were made a long time ago. So. So, any other questions? I think you had a question.
Yeah, American law reverts back to British common law when there isn't a precedent. And I think the Enigma machine was clearly during World War II. Couldn't that be sort of made into a
Well, one of the. Well, yeah, but the problem is we've got so many screwed up interpretations. And, for example, one of the topics I was going to cover in the verbose amount of information that I brought with me was, for example, one of the problems we had in this country where, just prior to World War II, we had like 27 states with eugenics laws on the books. And then you look at what happened in Germany, and everybody thinks, oh, you know, the hideous Nazi party did all this crap. The only thing Hitler needed to do when he came to power, because he was a fan of eugenics, was he translated the legislation out of the Commonwealth of Virginia and the United States into Germany. And was actually able to use our legislation. I mean, we actually took tens of thousands of our own citizens away from their homes and sterilized them against their will. And the really disgusting thing about this is the fact that most of them were about 11 and 12 years old. And even with our so-called right to keep and bear arms, there was not in one instance anybody I can find who pulled out a gun and said, this crap stops here. Instead, they went to the Supreme Court, the federal government, and they upheld the damn laws. So, I mean, when you look at an idiocy like that, I really can't see, based on the precedent we have right now, you being able to go into courts and say that there's a problem with the separation of power in the government based on Clipper, or that these various technologies, such as viruses, for example, I think is another example of a weapon. Instead of hacking kids' PCs out in the Midwest, maybe we've got to try and hack something a bit more constructive.
Yes. When?
Like the mobile subscriber equipment. Well, you've noticed that I conveniently dodged that nasty point, and that's a valid concern. One of the reasons the military has been able to construct so many cryptographic systems, and of course it doesn't use escrow key cryptography, is that it uses the national defense posture as an excuse for this. I don't see that being feasible for anywhere else in the government. So I'm just kind of sidestepping it. I haven't really done that much research on it or anything, so... I'd like to figure out a way to stop that, too, but, Christ, there's only so much you can do.
Do we have any other... Yes.
Yeah, my comment and suggestion about what I consider the biggest responsibility is that interface. Currently, I think the interface limit is used to technically be able to have control, and people who don't have that technical control will not have access to certain issues at all, and
Well, we are working on a new version of PGP that would have a better user interface. In order to do a graphical user interface, we had to change the structure of the code, which the currently deployed PGP shows the markings of software that has been touched by many hands. There's a certain amount of spaghetti in it. I'm bracing myself for the embarrassment of, in a few months, MIT Press is going to publish the entire source code of PGP in C in a book that can be bought at bookstores and public libraries. Lots of people are going to get a good look at it then that didn't want to take the trouble to look through their disk before. And they're going to find out there's a lot of spaghetti code in there. By the way, the reason why the book is being published is because the government looks upon books differently as far as export. not to change the subject to export control, but as long as I'm on the subject of the book, The first thing we're going to do is apply for a commodities jurisdiction, which is a ruling from the State Department that this item can be exported. It's kind of a silly thing to do for a book because they'll just laugh and say, why are you asking us? Of course it can be exported. But we want them to say so, and then we'll figure out where we can go from there. I wanted to say something about Mark's remarks. Earlier today, Dale Thackeray made some good observations about the need to be able to wiretap criminals, and there really are some really terrible criminals out there, and it concerns me that they'll use this technology. It makes me feel bad when I hear stories about criminals using PGP. But you can't stop them from doing it if you want to give this technology to the masses of people. As bad as criminals are, I think that historically more people have been killed by governments than by criminals. I didn't know about the numbers. I'm surprised at how high the numbers are in Mark's citations there. If these numbers are true, that's a shocking amount of numbers.
If they're true, oh,
well,
of course they are.
All right.
No.
That's a shocking amount of government abuse. And how many people have been killed by murderers in the 20th century? How many people did Hitler kill? Hitler killed more than all the serial murderers and kidnappers and criminals of all sorts all over the world for the entire century. And Hitler was a democratically elected government by a Western democracy. Economic conditions can change. Germany in the 1930s gave rise to the Third Reich. Russia in the 1990s is at risk of giving rise to fascism in Russia. Who knows what kind of economy we may face in decades hence, when perhaps 20 years from now, when there's 100 million Clipper phones installed. Are we going to bequeath to our next unknown government sometime 20 years from now a technology infrastructure that gives it the technical means of carrying out terrible policies against its people that it can so conveniently, much easier, carry out with those technical tools, the tools of tyranny? It's not so much that I distrust cops today, although certainly there are cops today that abuse their power, but a much more alarming possibility is the cops decades hence under a tyrannical government that could find itself the happy inheritor of a technology infrastructure that makes it oh so easy to hold on to power indefinitely.
Okay, we have another question here.
Did you say the RSA, what?
RSA 16.
I haven't heard about that one. You're talking about the factoring efforts, the recent RSA 129 cracking. Yeah. Okay. The question is, are the RSA keys in PGP going to be lengthened anytime soon? It seems like there's a lot of sentiment that the keys that it has are not safe. I think a lot of it comes from the RSA 129 factoring effort. A few months ago, an RSA key with 129 digits, decimal digits, was cracked. That's 440-some bits, I think, by a massive factoring effort requiring 8 months of time, 5,000 MIP years of effort by people in 20 countries. That was for a 129-digit number. My key, a 1024-bit key, has got 307 digits. the workload for factoring grows exponentially. I think that these keys are out of reach for quite a long time. It's not just increases in speed in silicon, but increases in speed in factoring algorithms. I do plan to lengthen the keys in PGP at some point, but there's I do these things very carefully to make sure that there's not too many disruptions in interoperability, compatibility. If somebody just lengthens it themselves, then they produce keys that other copies of PGP cannot read. It was a bug in PGP that allowed people to generate keys that were longer than 1024 bits. On some PGP implementations, it would break them. It would cause them to blow up, not just degrade gracefully and say, I can't use this key, but would actually terminate that normally. We fixed that bug. You can't generate keys now bigger than 1024 bits with PGP. And then RSAREF, the subroutine package from RSA Data Security that performs the RSA calculations now, also has a limit of 1024 bits. In order to get past this limit, we would have to look at what the legal implications of that are and whether we would be making ourselves vulnerable to legal harassment from RSA. The time scales for legal harassment like that are very short. We're looking at them over the next year or two. The time scales for worrying about the exposure of 1024-bit keys to factoring attacks is decades away, if not centuries, if not 100 years from now. To demand that we absolutely have to lengthen the keys from 1024 bits today because of some vulnerabilities that may exist many decades from now, it creates a problem, because in order to lengthen that, there are some legal implications for me to lengthen those keys. For one thing, it paints me into a corner about I would have to use only RSAREF. The patents are about to expire in 1997. Not for the RSA algorithm, but for the two other important algorithms, Diffie-Hellman and Hellman-Merkle, which would allow switching to an entirely different public key algorithm. And I have to consider the possibility of switching to that algorithm. And some of those algorithms are slower than RSA. And not just for the secret key, but for the public key, which means that if people switch over to lengthier keys now, if we switch to, say, El Gamal, for example, another public key scheme, every time anyone used public keys that are long, they would suffer a tremendous performance hit. And so I'm balancing all kinds of things. There's the patent situation, there's the RSA rep licensing situation, there's the legal harassment from the patent holders in general to all the users of PGP, which has been tremendously improved now by the MIT situation. We've really won the battle, and I'd like to try to see where we can go from here carefully without being pressured relentlessly by militant crypto anarchists who want to have 8,000-bit keys because the Star Trek computer on the Enterprise could possibly break their 1024-bit key.
Are there any other questions? Oh, yellow shirt.
And the statute of limitations would have expired. Thanks.
Any other questions? Yes?
You mean that thing where you can specify the size of the public exponent?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was way back in PGP 1.0 for experimental purposes, and it never got taken out.
Is there any kind of consideration with a small one and a large one versus?
There's nothing that means anything in any real world terms. It was just for fooling around. There's there's some very esoteric attacks on pure RSA schemes that can take advantage of small exponents, but PGP is designed in such a way that completely avoids those attacks.
Any other questions? No? Okay, thank you.